Hospitalitychain.com, the world's first online hub designed for the hospitality, culinary, and catering industry. From leading food and beverage brands to professional food service equipment, Hospitalitychain.com makes sourcing simple. Search, select, buy direct, and save all in one global marketplace.
He said, okay, listen, to be successful, you have to understand that hospitality is not a job. It's a lifestyle. There's no hours. Do you understand? And, you know, at the time, of course I understand, right? I had no idea what he's talking about. And then you start to realize as you get older and you become more professional and you're like, you're right. There are no hours. You don't clock in. You don't clock out. You're on all the time.
Welcome back to another episode of the Fell Into Food Podcast, the soon-to-be home of the number one food podcast in the nation. I am your host, Chef Jeff Fell. With me today is Seth Alexander, the co-founder of Barrel Age Management. He brings 25 years of experience in food and beverage and real estate. He specializes in partnering with developers and brands to conceptualize and reposition projects into successful industry-leading hospitality ventures. Known for his hands-on approach, Seth works closely with teams to improve efficiency, profitability, and operational excellence, serving as a trusted advisor through every stage of development. He's collaborated with top hotel brands including Four Seasons, Lucien Barrière, The Edition, and Ritz-Carlton. Seth has also worked with Michelin and James Beard-nominated chefs and restaurants. He also has partnered with major developers such as the Howard Hughes, Bedrock Ventures, Lightstone Group, and Related Group to bring thoughtful, impactful concepts to life. His passion lies in creating venues that leave a lasting impression on both guests and stakeholders, combining strategic vision with a deep understanding of what makes hospitality experiences resonate. Barrel Age Management is a hospitality advisory and development studio specializing in master planning, leadership sourcing, hotel portfolio repositioning, strategic partnerships, and operations. His mission is to craft authentic, inspired spaces that foster connection and community, prioritizing creative and thoughtfulness over formulaic solutions. Seth, welcome to the program.
Wow, thank you. That was fantastic.
I'm glad you liked it. I really want to talk about what you're doing now, but I think we need to set the stage a little bit. And I was reading a little bit about your background, and I love the story about your grandfathers because it's really grounded. And normally in the kitchen, we hear about grandmothers, or a lot of the people I talk to, it's usually chefs, and they're always talking about their grandmothers, and that's how they got in the kitchen. So, you know, your story with your two grandfathers, one running a deli or owning a deli and the other being a developer, you know, it's a little bit more on the business side. So I'm curious, did having the business first foundation make it harder for you to embrace the warm and fuzzy side of hospitality, or did it just already come naturally?
I'd say it came naturally. I mean, although one of my grandpas was a developer, he was not, you know, your quintessential of what you see in movies. You know, he wasn't cutthroat. He wasn't diehard. You know, he was a tough guy, you know, there, you know, from the old country. But, you know, I think that he really loved hospitality. You know, now where hospitality restaurants really kind of take the lead in multi-development, back then it didn't. But he always liked having one restaurant or, you know, bistro or cafe because he felt that it created a little bit more like authenticity to his developments. So, you know, I think he was a visionary back then. So he always kind of had that, right? So it wasn't always just about the business, and he partnered with some really great tenants, and that had a very nice, like, family mentality to it. And then my grandpa Hal, who was who owned the Jewish deli, it just exuded him. You know, like, there was really no business side of hospitality. It was just hospitality. And, you know, when you're serving breakfast to blue hairs in, you know, South Florida, you really get to see the challenges of it and, like, how you deal with it at a very young age. So I think that, you know, that kind of resonated with me kind of forever, right? Where the challenge of the business isn't necessarily just the business. It's our guests sometimes and, like, how you are proactive and how you deal with them and work with them, right? So I think, like, getting that at a young age, it just became kind of second nature.
And were you in the kitchen a lot, you know, having a deli? Were you there quite a bit?
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I am a modern family. I was raised by a single mother who put herself through law school. So most of the summers I spent with my grandparents, you know, while she was going to school. And, you know, we had, my grandma was an artist, and then my grandpa owned these delis, and we used to spend basically every day with him there. You know, my first gig, I thought I'd be kind of like in the front of house, you know, making the milkshakes and cutting the bagels. But like I said, from the old country, it was in the dish. You know, he's like, that's where everybody starts, and that's where you got to learn. And, you know, you kind of go from there. But no, we spent a lot of time, not necessarily in the kitchen, but we'll call, you know, behind the deli counter, right? Sandwich maker, bagel spreader, all that kind of fun things. But yeah, I spent a lot of time there, probably from 5 to 10.
Wow. Yeah, that definitely cut your teeth, at least being around the industry, seeing it. And that kind of leads to the sandwich maker story when you're around 13, 14. And they, you know, they gave you the keys, right? Like you said, you're a teenager, you're opening up the store. Do you think it was because, you know, you had worked in that kind of environment? Or how did you convince them that you were the responsible type?
Oh, so this wasn't my grandpa's deli. So he, you know, so he fell ill, unfortunately, ended up kind of partnering with each one of the GMs so they could, you know, take the reins, which was amazing. And, you know, they were a little further from me. So I decided I'm going to get a job at another deli down the street. And yeah, I definitely, you know, I think you will, how would you call it? You know, fake the funk, right? Like, oh, I worked in a deli and I used to do this and I used to do that. And they're like, okay. And after a couple of weeks, they were like, yeah, you know, you live close, gave me the keys. I mean, I don't know who would give the keys to like a 13-year-old, you know, especially now. It's like, I would never do that. But yeah, so they gave me the keys and I don't even remember. I think I overslept or something. And this was before, you know, caller ID was very popular, right? It was one of those things that hopefully just businesses had. So, you know, I learned very young, always tell the truth. So I called them and I was like, oh, you know, my bike popped a tire and I couldn't get there in time and, you know, something. And they're like, we have you on caller ID. You are still at your house. You do not need to come in. Please drop off the keys today. Wow. And that was it. Wow. That was it.
So was it what was the biggest lesson out of that? Was it the lying thing or was there something even bigger that you still kind of hold with you to today?
Well, you know, two things. So I'll tell you that. So, I'll be honest, right? So that night before that I was supposed to open at, you know, I think it was 6 o'clock in the morning. I stayed up until, you know, God knows, midnight, 1 a.m. playing video games. And I don't remember what it was. And then obviously the line. So the two things was I stopped playing video games and I did not play video games again until literally last year when I bought my daughter a Nintendo Switch. I've never played them. And then, yes, the lying was, you know what? It is much better to just tell the truth. And, you know, it's hard to keep up the lie. And those have kind of just stayed with me forever, right? Like our business, there's always challenges. There's always something that kind of happens. And, you know, we've all been at a restaurant where the food takes forever. And they're like, oh, the kitchen lost the ticket. And, you know, they just didn't ring it in, right? Or they forgot an allergen, right? Like, just tell the truth. But yeah, those two were like the foundation lessons I learned from that.
Yeah, I would say pretty good foundational lessons to have and at least learned early, earlier than later. Get some of that wisdom, as we always talk about. You know, you get older and then you find things out and you're like, damn, I wish I would have had either learned the lesson earlier or someone would have just told me, mentored me so I didn't make that mistake, because that's the absolute worst.
100%.
So you do this deli thing, you know, high school, then where did you, you know, kind of all of a sudden you kind of get into these big groups, management groups. And I want people to hear, because I haven't had anyone on that's been part of these management groups. And I've dabbled with talking to some of them, been to their places, seen their facilities, but really painting a picture of what the groups are. You know, you got in pretty early, right? With like MGM, it was, I want to say, what, your mid-20s? How did that all come about? And then, you know, you're in front of like people who are making massive decisions, doing big projects. Did you do the same thing, the fake the funk? And what was that like?
Yeah, you know, I think that, you know, we're lucky enough, and I think we still see it today, that no matter how big the company or how large the hedge fund, right, they always want the authentic mom and pop, right? They always do. And we've seen it, right? We've seen, you know, major hotels give opportunities to very small infrastructured chefs or restaurateurs, and they don't pan out, right? Because they're like, listen, they went from running a 65-seat restaurant to a 200-room hotel with six outlets, and then they didn't do well, and they get upset. I mean, you know, whose fault is that? You know, for me, I was lucky enough where, you know, I started in the brick and mortars. So, you know, when I was about 16, so this is 96, I was a street sweeper passing out flyers. You could call it a promoter for nightclubs, right? So
okay. This
was like back in the day, South Beach, you know, obviously before social media and all of those things. And, you know, we used to literally ride our bikes and pass out flyers to people to try to get them to come to the nightclubs. And then after that, it became, you know, trying to get people's phone numbers so you could call them to be on lists. And that's really how I got into hospitality there from the delis. It was during my kind of later high school days, I started doing that, right? And then that kind of led into college, started bartending. I was really more in the nightclub space. And then I think around like, I'd probably say like 99, I realized, you know, I really wanted to do more food, right? Like the nightclub business was just a little shadier, right, back then. You know, I had a lot of friends who, you know, couldn't, you know, keep up with the lifestyle, and kind of saw what happened there. And I had met a chef here in Miami named Mark Militello. He owned a place called Mark's, in South Beach. And he was really kind of one of the founding chef-driven concepts. You know, you had like Norman Van Aken, and you had Militello, you had Bernstein, and, he offered me a job, food running. And I remember I came in, and there was a chef, Larry Lavallee, and he was just a really nice guy in comparison to the chefs I was used to. And he started teaching me about food. And I just loved it, right? And then just from working in those small mom and pops, one of the gentlemen who was involved in the nightclub was opening a steakhouse with a restaurateur in South Beach called Prime 112, which became a very famous steakhouse in South Florida and Miami, probably one of the top for years. And one night while just working service, I met a gentleman from Las Vegas. And he said, listen, you know, I think I got into some type of argument with my owner about something. You know, these are old school steakhouses, right? Like busy and buzzy. And, you know, you're yelling at each other about table times and everything. And this gentleman overheard and he said, listen, you know, have you ever thought about moving out to Las Vegas and going to the big time? Right. Like, this is a great restaurant, but, you know, you have to see what's happening there. And I was like, sure. So I went out there and, you know, after 3 days, I loved it. And then after working with them only for about 6 months, and this was right when management deals, I don't know if you're familiar with that structure, where you basically partnered with the hotel on the venues, right? You didn't own anything, but you kind of managed it for them. That was when they first became popular. So there were like three groups that were just attacking Vegas, right? Mm-hmm. That were just as many venues as you could get. And these are, you know, tons of casinos at the time. And they just created a task force to just go and open restaurants, open nightclubs, just go in there, get the concept going, hire the people, and then go to the next one. And at that point, I was pretty young and I was like, oh, well, you know, I did this and I did that and I'm from Miami and I know nightclubs and I know restaurants and I know, you know, everything about everything, you know, put me in, coach. And they were like, all right, you know, like, just here you go. And, you know, from there, it just kind of grew, right? After Vegas, I came back to Miami and we were in a major development. And then you had a lot of attention from outside of Miami, you know, New York, London, LA, and these major groups were coming down here. And I just became, you know, I kind of got a reputation for helping out-of-state groups understand the Miami demographic, right? I knew a lot of the people, I knew the purveyors, I knew the employees, I knew, you know, the linen companies, the ice companies, and I just kind of always sold that, right? Like, oh, well, if you're opening in Miami and you're like, you know, in the Wild West, you need someone that knows, you know, the terrain, and that's me. And it just kind of grew from there.
Okay, so going back to when you were having that disagreement and that gentleman who overheard that conversation, like, what are the odds that somebody just overhears that kind of conversation and says, hey, do you want to move to Vegas? Like, was he there on business? Like, do you think that's luck? Do you think that's, like, divine intervention? What would you consider that as?
You know, I would definitely call it, you know, so it's a word I use. My wife jokes around with me. Serendipitous.
Okay.
You know, I don't like being called lucky, because, you know, there's a lot of things, obviously, as you know, being in hospitality, you know, when you become a professional hospitarian, there's a lot of sacrifice, right? Missing birthdays, missing graduations, and, you know, coming home that evening, you never feel lucky, right? But I do think that there is a level of serendipitous in hospitality, right? The one thing I always loved about it, it's kind of like Night at the Roxbury's, right? Remember that movie?
I love that movie. Love it.
You know, and you just never know, right? Hospitality, you never know. You could always go in and you could meet that person. You could cook them a meal. You could, you know, treat them a certain way, and it could change your entire life, right? And that's happened to me a few times, you know, with this one. He was a regular of mine. He happened to be just best friends with a major restaurateur in Las Vegas, and he was there as well. So basically, it was like a friendly dinner that he invited this gentleman to check out this brand new Miami steakhouse. We were about opened, I think, for about a year. And I think that, you know, it's just that cosmic, you know, if you had to call it, right?
Yeah.
It's probably the best way to describe it, I think.
Well, and or like, rather than saying you got lucky, like you can create your own luck, right? That
right.
You put yourself in a position for that conversation to happen or be overheard to then put you in an even better position. And you talked a lot about too, you said you knew all the purveyors, you knew what was going on, like through your career and the connection that we have in food. And I tell people, either reframe it as the biggest, smallest industry, the smallest, biggest industry, because everyone knows everyone. And some way or another, there's a touch point, and you don't know who you're going to run into or connect to at some given point. What were some of those other serendipitous times? And maybe it was through one of those connections that, you know, helped continue your career.
So another one was, you know, I had moved back to Miami. So I was in Vegas during the real estate crash.
Okay.
Right. Of 08. And at that time, MGM, or I think Aria City Center, they claimed bankruptcy. Right. And there was a lot of things that kind of spawned from that. Right. Where the Grutman Live Fountain Blue situation kind of grew from that tragedy in Vegas. So I had come back and I was working at a restaurant, and a gentleman comes in late night. You know, kind of at that point where, you know, all the servers are looking at you. I was a general manager at the time. Gentleman comes in, and, you know, it's that time where everyone wants you to say, hey, we're closed, buddy, right? Because we know, you know, he's coming in 10 minutes before.
Yep.
It's going to be an hour, 2 hours, you know, the chefs are staring at me, right? It's like that scene in Waiting. They're all just like, oh, my God, if he seats them, I'm gonna kill him. But, you know, I had that old school mentality, right? We're not closed and we're going to treat him like we just opened, and he's going to come in and we're going to do it. So he comes in and, you know, he has a great dinner, and we spent a little bit of time. He's asking me lots of questions, English gentleman. And I was like, okay, you know, and as he leaves, he gives me his card, and it was Jonathan Siegel, who was the CEO of The One Group, owned STK, Bagatelle, all these brands. And he said, listen, I'm opening a steakhouse right at the Gansevoort Hotel. And we're looking for people, right? Here's my card. I'd love for you to call me personally. And I said, sure. Yeah. You know, guy's not going to answer, right?
Right.
So, you know, I think I get home and I lose the card. And then, you know, during one of those like laundry days, I found it. I decided to call him. And it just 2 days later, I'm sitting in front of five people from his company. And the next day, they bring me on and they send me to New York.
Wow.
So that was another one.
That's crazy. But again, it's, I think, creating your own luck. Like, you, you didn't have to be, you could have been the guy that was like, nope, sorry, we're closing, and made the staff happy, but you didn't. You said, nope, we're in hospitality. We're going to treat him just as if he walked in at prime dinner time. And I think people are rewarded for that. I think what comes around goes around. I'm a big believer of the karma kind of energy. You know, you do good things. Things will come back to you. You may not know how it's going to happen, when it's going to happen. And in the moment, it may suck because everyone probably hated you. They were probably like, Are you kidding me? This mother making us stay late tonight. Yeah. But in the long run, right, it was the right thing. And that's what we should be doing in hospitality, is taking care of people. It doesn't matter. And I had some chefs that told me that. They're like, it doesn't matter if people walk in 5 minutes before you close or right when you open. They should be treated with the same exact food that you would get at any period of service. And it was hard when I was in my mid-20s to like swallow that. I'm like, I want to get the hell out of here. I don't want to be here. I got 2 hours of cleaning to do. I want to go home. Yeah. And then as you get older, you kind of realize, that is the right thing to do. And it sucks in the moment, but that's what you should be doing. So you've been working with these big companies, and I kind of want to fast forward through that. You know, usually two people leave those kind of big, nice, cushy jobs for a couple reasons. Either A, they think they can do it better, or they're just not happy, right? Which one was it for you?
You know, Scott, I don't want to be that guy. Neither.
Okay.
I loved what I did. I don't think I could do it better, you know, than a lot of the people that I have worked for, right? There's a certain level of sacrifice that I'm not willing to make. Right. You know, I had left my last, I guess you'd call it, they weren't a corporate company, but we'll say a large group during COVID. Right. So I was one of those traditional stories where I was working for a pretty large company at the time. You know, we had about, you know, call it give or take around 1200 employees. You know, by prime COVID, I was one of four. And as we started turning the lights back on, you know, there was a lot of challenges during COVID, obviously, right? And I had always had barrel age management. You know, it was a kind of a fallback when I was doing development for some of my companies, doing some recruiting for friends of the businesses that I worked with. And during COVID, there were a lot of smaller companies that, you know, I was part of Roar, and we were doing all these podcasts kind of started, and how you kind of like, how do you turn on the lights? How do you turn off the lights? What are we doing? HACCP plans, you know, what's the rule this week? You know, there was a lot of community happening, and I was getting a lot of, calls from smaller groups, friends of mine, people that I had just met. And I really liked it. Right. And then as the lights started coming back on, and I think that, you know, none of us knew how to deal with a pandemic. And I think myself and the company that I worked for probably could have done things better. I mean, we didn't have the information, right? But I think we could have communicated that better. And, you know, it just didn't feel the same, right? And it was like, I didn't want to be that guy working with the people who may have looked at me in a different way. I had my second daughter during COVID. My family, unfortunately, I had some illness, and we wanted to come back so my children could have the relationship with their grandparents like I did. So we moved back to Miami. And then barrel age just, you know, I feel somewhat guilty, but we were positioned for a pandemic, you know, because we did task force and we did repositioning and we did, you know, a lot of these different advisory roles. And so a company like ours works very well in that type of catastrophe, right? Because you don't want to commit to hiring these huge teams. You want to be able to kind of ebb and flow as you go. You want people who can provide information based on previous experiences of primes or lows. So we were kind of positioned in a good place. And, you know, I just said, listen, I'm just going to commit to this and let's go, right? Spend more time with my kids because obviously, you know, in those roles, I couldn't do that, and made the transition. But, you know, I miss working with those groups. I miss running like my own brands. But I still get the level of like kind of mentorship and being able to have my own schedule and, you know, work with different styles of clients. But that's why I made the transition.
Yeah, that's It's interesting. It's funny how COVID has changed so many lives, good, bad, and like in just the way that it all comes full circle. And yeah, a lot of shit went down during COVID. You know,
our whole industry changed.
Completely. And so I want to get into barrel age management. You know, it's not just you. You're in this with your wife, right, Amy?
Yes. Yes.
Right. So she's your business partner. And, you know, a lot of people say, don't go into business with your partner. It usually ends up that one is running a business. The other kind of just like is in the shadows doing bookkeeping or accounting or something. But you guys are like business partners, right? Like she's kind of the, from what I've read, the creative director, the dreamer. And then you're kind of that strategist who makes all the math work. Am I correct on that?
It pretty similar. I mean, she does a lot of operational work, a lot of brand work. I do a lot of development work and I'm a little bit more on like the real estate kind of concept development side.
Okay.
Of it. But,
okay.
You know, she was, you know, she is, but if we had to call it, let's call it corporate world, but it wasn't really corporate, but the professional world, you know, she was a beast. You know, she started with Hakkasan and she helped grow that company. You know, she worked for Seidel opening the Nomads and the Freehands and the Soros. And, you know, then she worked for, she was the vice president of Montage and Pendry. And at that point, you know, Barrel Age was doing pretty well. I had an opportunity to partner with a pretty infamous brand, you know, Bar Lab, which was like a very cocktail driven company, which was taking a lot of time. And, you know, she saw the time that we put into it and she's like, I'm not letting it just kind of go away. I'm going to quit too. And I'm going to take over. And, you know, she really did bring it to another level. You know, I was a little bit more like chefs and kind of smaller groups. And, you know, she realized like, no, we are made for hotel portfolios, right? Like, yeah, helping a chef, helping a restaurant group, that's great. But we need to go after hotel portfolios that don't have F&B infrastructure. And that's what we're going to do. And and she, you know, she took it by the reins. And I mean, we started signing, you know, portfolios, you know, where I would get like maybe a restaurant or like, you know, helping a chef open something or, you know, we were getting full 5, 6, 7, 8 hotel portfolios. And I mean, you know, who else? Are you married?
Yeah. Yeah.
So I always find it funny, right? Because people are like, how do you get in business with your wife, right? And the hardest business is the family business, right? That's the hardest one.
Yep.
And that's your partner, right? That's like your real partner. The 50-50, you know, we all know that's nonsense. I can't remember a woman, she wrote a book about parenting and how you're never 50-50, right? One day you're 30.
Is it the 80-20 or the, it's the 80-20 rule or something like that?
Right.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
I'm 30, you're 70 today, tomorrow, you know, you got to be a 90, I'm only a 10, right? You're never 50-50, but by the end of the year, you probably average out. So, you know, you look at it and you say, well, who else would I go into an actual business with if not my wife, right? We're already in the hardest business together. So it's funny when you hear people say it, but then you're like, are you married? You're like, yeah. And you're like, oh, you're already in business. the only difference is you're not getting paid. So, you know.
That's a great way to put it. That is right? a great way to put it.
But, you know, we have our ups and downs, but I do like it. It's also, you know, you're a chef, so you'll understand. Is that hospitality, I think, you know, this is the grandpa that owned the deli when I decided I wanted to do this business, right? He really was trying to talk me out of it. He was like, you know, don't go into this, go be a lawyer, you know, go be a doctor, like, don't do this. And I said, no, this is what I want to do. And he said, okay, listen, to be successful, you have to understand that hospitality is not a job, it's a lifestyle. There's no hours. Do you understand? And, you know, at the time, of course I understand, right? I had no idea what he's talking about. And then you start to realize as you get older and you become more professional and you're like, you're right. There are no hours. You don't clock in. You don't clock out. You're on all the time. And, you know, I think having someone who is in the hospitality business as well, even when we were working for different companies, you know, she understood. Sometimes I come home and if I'm not talking, it's not because I'm mad. It's because I had a crazy shift, right? Getting yelled at by 1,000 people and I don't want to talk, right? And like, that's a hard thing, I think, to explain to someone who's not in our industry and they're waiting all day to see you, right? And they're excited and they want to hear about your day. And, you know, you just come home and you're like, and they know, right? They're like, okay. Mm-hmm. Or you come home and they're like, I cooked this beautiful dinner. And you're like, I want a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. That's what I want. That's the only thing I want, right? And they're, someone would get upset with that, right? So I think like that worked out very well for us. And we get our kids involved. You know, we'll do a site tour and my daughter will come with her little, you know, notepad and walk around and count covers with me and like tell me all the things that would be great for a family hotel. So it's become a real lifestyle and we just blend it pretty well together.
And how old's your daughter?
I have two. So I have an 8-year-old and I have a 4-year-old.
Oh, wow. So you got her starting young at 8, really, really into the business, which is, which is fantastic. And I think hospitality, there's just so many lessons like you learned as a kid. There's just so many lessons you can learn that are timeless. Doesn't matter what area you grew up in, the restaurant is the restaurant and things change, you know, which is good and bad, right? Things need to change. But those lessons, I think, kind of stick around forever.
100%.
Not in the same aspect. My daughter's 9. And it's more on the video side. She really enjoys this video production. She's always wanting, hey, can I jump on camera? Can you teach me how to do this? Which it's a little more, I got to be a little more guarded just because of, you know, the web and there's crazy people out there and what can be seen. But because I was going to ask you, you know, you said it doesn't really, there are no hours. How do you then like switch off, like when it is family, like true family time, how do you switch that on and off, right? If you're constantly on it, how do you switch it off and go into like family mode and like be the dad, be the husband?
Well, I will, if my wife was listening, I'm not very good at that. It is the one thing that I will, well, not one, but like there's a lot of things that we know, you know, we all have to get better at. And like that is definitely mm-hmm. mine. You know, when I left the we'll call it the corporate side, I definitely try as much as possible, right? And, you know, so much is like you leave your phone in a certain room from certain times, right? We'll try mm-hmm. that. But, you know, it's funny because where we have our failures, we find our successes is not so much with my youngest, but with my 8-year-old, you know, I get her involved a little bit, right? Where it's like the way I looked at it was, I can't remember who told me, it was another chef. But you know, he said, listen, when I was having my kid, my second child during COVID, and he said, and I was like kind of freaking out. And he was like, listen, you know, all the stuff, right? I know you're going to read the books and all the things and, you know, the what to expect app and when it's 2 and 3 and what they should be doing. He goes, listen, only things that matters is quality time. I promise, quality time. So, you know, if I have to do a project and it's late night and I'm supposed to be with my kids and doing something, I'll have her come over to the computer and I'll say, hey, listen, and we'll kind of do some things together. And okay. To her, it's kind of fun, right? And it's just about the time, you know, vacations. Mm-hmm. That's probably my worst. That's my worst. Is like I had definitely gone on vacations where like it's a beach vacation and I don't put on my bathing suit. So I'm getting better at that. But I would probably say to answer the question, working hard at it and continuing to try.
Yeah, that's all you can do, right? You can continue to try, keep growing, developing, doing your best. To your point, I like what you said, though, with like even if you're working and your daughter comes, she just views it as time. And it's still undivided time, right? Because you're spending time with her on 100%. Whatever is you're focused on and not the I'm playing with you, but I'm on my phone, right? Where it's clearly not a divided attention. And that's what they see. So I really like that.
That's what I think it's about, right? Where it's like when you're saying, you know, spend time with your kids or the importance of doing it, you know, they just want the attention. So it's like if you can do something while spending time with them, that's what they want. Right. To your point, how many times you go to a park and you see the parents on their phone on a bench? Right. And you're like, well, that's not really spending time. Like I just did an entire spatial plan with my 8-year-old for 2 hours. Right. Like,
right.
You know, we really talk things out. Right. So it's like it's a different scenario. But like I said, it's a lifestyle point. And she also loves it. You know, she's been on like 50 flights. You know, she's gone to 7 countries. Like to her, it's normal.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I love it. All right. I read your mission statement and it says you prioritize creativity and thoughtfulness over formulaic solutions, correct? What, you know,
what does that mean?
But like in your first half of the career, I would assume like working with these big groups, was it where you had to kind of put systems in place and things were very the opposite, right? Where they were these blueprints where you could go in, get these places up and running, or was it the opposite when you were in those places? And then why is that now? Why is that the priority?
So when I was more in operations working with brands, and more like line level, right? And we were opening restaurants, traditionally outposts, right? They were either based in New York or they were based in like in LA, and we're opening in a different location. And, you know, this is before all of that. You know, we said, well, you do need those systems, right? Like, how do we create the consistencies? You know, I worked during some of my college years, I worked for Hillstones, Houston's group. And, you know, they're the best at that, right? Like the consistency and the training and like the real. And I said, well, let's take that to the more boutique kind of chef driven, culinary driven type of outlet. So building that, realize, okay, so you need it, right? Like you need that to create the consistency, to create the confidence for ownership groups and for, you know, executive chefs and directors of operations to be able to allow a property level to run their own store, right? Because then they'd be like, well, what are you doing if you're not doing right. What the book says, right? So then we started creating that. And then once I got to more of like the ownership level, working with, you know, the family offices and the real estate companies and the asset managers, you started realizing, well, wow, this is like real systematic. And you're not even thinking about like the soul here, right? Mm. And I think the difference between like real estate development and like retail in comparison to hospitality is like we create experiences. Right. It's like, yes, we cook and yes, we make cocktails and, you know, we do all these things. But like, really, we're creating experiences for people. And the best experience is an authentic one. Right. And mm-hmm. you can't plan authenticity. So we started realizing, well, you know, if you hired us for like asset performance as opposed to an asset manager has a checklist. Right. They come in and they do the same 15 things for every single client they have. That's just what they do. That's their system. But then you start realizing, well, the ownership may have different priorities, right? The location may have totally different demographics and markets, and you can't use this one formula everywhere, right? So you are creating this box that every hotel or every development has to follow and live in, and then you get sterile experiences, right? So we started saying, well, you know, we don't do this formula. There is no formula, right? There's ways to strategize and navigate, but you and I both know that there's no one way to do things in hospitality ever, right? And the companies that come and, you know, the consultants and the advisors, and they come in and they're, oh, well, I can, you know, I can fix this and I can do this because I have the formula. And you're like, well, I'd love to know what that is. And maybe that'll work for here in Miami, but you're telling me it'll also work for my venue in Charleston?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And oh, yeah, 100%. It's a proven formula. And I think that like breaking that box and just kind of being very clear of saying, listen, we focus on a lot of different things, but we don't say there's one formula. What we will do and what we will say is we are very good at analyzing and strategizing analytics across lots of different pieces of information, and then we create the tailor-made for the concept, right? And I think that's how most people create a recipe, right? That's how most people create a design, where they say, okay, I need all my tools, right? Mm-hmm. And now I'm going to paint. And most of the time, it'll come out different.
Yeah, totally. Now, I'm looking back on my career. I worked mostly in the college world, and it was very, very systematic because you're feeding thousands of people every single day. But I do start thinking about all the different places and the demographics, from Chicago to Indianapolis to little Bemidji, Minnesota, and how they had to be tailored. I start just us talking about it. Really, I never thought about it. I was like, no, this is the system. I go in, this is what I do. But then when you start talking, looking at the people, people's the grand unknown, right? What, how do they feel? What kind of team do you right. have? What is the structure at the place you're at? Union, non-union, male, female?
What's your talent pool? Yeah, it's
talent,
it's totally
older, younger,
different.
And you can't be like, okay, here's the system, and this is going to be exactly how we run our labor. Well, that's great that it worked in the Chicago model where, you know, you got a kitchen and it's got 80 people. But what happens when you go up to Minnesota and there's a team of five? Right. Yeah. And you expect that same level of consistency and execution. It just doesn't work. And you, so you have to tweak. You have to tweak what it is. And really, under, to your point, you have to gather all the information, gather the facts, then build the plan. Because without that, the plan is the plan, right? And to your point, a recipe is a recipe. If you go up into
like
altitude,
roadmap, right?
Yeah.
Like you could have a roadmap. Or, my God, nowadays, right? You could be following Waze, right? Not even, you know, listening to music, chatting, not even paying attention, just following the blue line. But then if lightning hits and a tree drops, like, what do you do? You can't keep following Waze, right? Because Waze doesn't know that the tree fell, right? So it's just going to keep saying, go in this direction, and you can't do it. So what do you do, right? Mm-hmm. And I feel like a lot of, unfortunately, at our level, a lot of asset managers and a lot of advisors, they don't see the tree. Mm-hmm. They just start blaming other systems. Oh, well, it's the chef, or oh, it's the GM, or oh, it's the season, or oh, it's all of these other things. It can't be my map that's wrong. It's got to be all these other things, right? When you and I know, when you're looking at it, if you lift the tree, you can go right ahead, right? But sometimes you can't. And sometimes, like, you know, we did a project where we're opening a steakhouse for someone and they took us to some comp set to New York, right? Like, we're in New York, let's go to the best. So we go, and then we go to his third tier city. And he says, I want to do the same thing. We said, okay, well, you don't have the staff. You cannot do it. Like, we can get the food and we can get the design. We can do those two things. The service, we have to change it, right? So we end up realizing, well, they have a couple talented people. You know, let's go back to the old school captain system, right? Where there's four people who the guests are speaking to and everybody else is helping, you know, keep things rolling. And that works because they didn't have the talent pool there to have, you know, 15 servers a night.
Right.
They could get a lot of support staff, but they couldn't get a lot of leads. So that one little adaptation, we were able to create this concept, right? It's a little bit different, but it still kind of works for that market, right? So it's like sometimes you're pretty close, but you have to be able to ebb and flow.
Yeah. You also have a philosophy of talent in the trenches. What's that mean?
Well, so... I'll bring it back. I'll be somewhat cliche, right? I'll bring it back to my definition of hospitality, right? So I call it, it's the proactive exceeding of expectations driven by genuine care for someone else's feelings, their comfort, their experience, despite one's personal views and current position, right? So talent in the trenches is getting it done. Right. Where sometimes it's not about, you know, like you said, you were a chef, right? So you're on the line and you're in the prime and you're in the weeds and you yell out, you know, grab me this. And the person looks at you and goes, don't talk to me that way. And you're like, what? What did I say? I said, get me this. Yeah, but you didn't say please. And you're like, what? Are you serious? Let's pretend we're in a war, right? You never ask someone to duck, please, right? Because the shots are being fired. You just yell out duck because you're in the trenches, right? And we're all doing it for the same reason. We're not doing it for ourselves. We're doing it for someone else. And like hospitality is hard because there's a level of servitude. Like there is, right? You're putting someone else's thoughts and feelings and experience above your own. Right. Mm-hmm. So I call it, you know, the talent is in the trenches. It's the people who can put their head down and just do what kind of needs to be done for the sake of someone else. And that's great hospitality.
Yeah.
Sounds a little 100%.
Rough. Yeah. But it's the truth, right? When people just get shit done. Right. And they can create those experiences. That's what it's all about. What you know, let's looking towards the future, right? We just hit 2026. You know, what's exciting for you in hospitality as a whole, right? It doesn't have to be just with the real estate and like development, but what's exciting you in this industry?
I love the adventurous spirit that's continuing post-COVID, right? I love that you can get the same ADR at a glamping site than you can an addition in Times Square, right? There are people who will pay $500 a night for a yurt in North Carolina, which is the same price as an addition on Miami Beach, which gives opportunity to a lot of smaller companies, right? And sometimes just families, right? Like, I love that people have started to replace the quintessential luxury with experiential luxury. I love that, right? And that could be, you know, a chef grilling something very unique, you know, outside of a prefab cabin, right? Or that could be a, you know, a curated trip somewhere. You know, people are kind of changing their own definitions of what luxury and lifestyle are now, where, you know, back then, you know, Ian Schrager coined the boutique hotel and everybody took it, right? And it's like, you could have a 150 room hotel with five outlets and that's boutique. And you're like, that's not really boutique. Yeah. So I love that that definition is starting to change. I think that's very exciting and it leads to so many different things, right? I also like that people are starting to step away from the addiction of the award programs, you know, like the Marriotts, the Hyatts, the Highgates. I love those brands. I think they create very, very unique projects and spaces and careers for people. But at a certain point, people stopped exploring the independence, right? And now people are doing it more often and so much so that they're actually looking for them, right? And I think that allows people who didn't have opportunities prior during that trend to be successful. And now it does. And it just, it opens it up, right? And I think that's amazing.
Now, do you think these experiences are becoming more affordable? Like people could actually afford it rather than the luxury lifestyle and what we just talked about?
You know, I think there's options, right? Like, no, I don't think it has evolved to where it will, right? Because again, I think it's like a little bit newer of a sector in a way. I mean, don't get me wrong, people have been glamping and camping like forever, but in this style, I think now people find comfort. That's not the word. People find the confidence in the luxury quotation, right? Like if I said to you, there's a luxury glamping site with all the things that you're going to need and you're with your family and you don't really know where it is, that term luxury makes you feel a little bit more comfortable as opposed to like, hey, I got a great camping site. And then you'll be like, I don't know what that means. Like, am I going to get there? Is there going to be running water? Like, I have my kid with me. So I think as people start to get a little bit more used to that style of travel and accommodation, it'll be a little bit more on an entry level. But I think now it's kind of helping grow it, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, totally makes sense. Yeah. What are your thoughts on AI? I've been asking everybody about it because it's a part of, it's an integral part of our lives. I mean, whether you like it or you don't, it's there. It's been around. So what are your general thoughts? Where do you think it has a place in our industry?
Yeah. I mean, so, well, twofold question. I'll tell you how we use it. So we were an early adopter. We created a proprietary system utilizing AI and analytics to help with a lot of our initial kind of intelligence gathering, right? I love AI from more of the left side, right? Where I think it's great at analyzing lots of information. I think it's really great at aggregating different filters to better understand guests, prices, projections. I think the challenge that we're having it now are, I feel like someone's going to take this and make something negative out of it, but I think people are getting a little lazy using it for creative. I don't think that AI should be utilized as a gap between touch points. Like when you call and it's a reservationist, that's AI, right? Like I don't think it should be in that realm. I think that taking the information that's out there, because there's so much now, right? There's so much information that it's hard to aggregate it, right? Even just to process it, and using AI to filter through it and give you a little bit more clarity into all of the information you could find out there. You know, even you with podcasts, right? If you just said, here's, you know, 25 different podcasts, each one have 100 episodes. I want to listen to every single one so I can make mine better. You can't do that. You don't have the time.
Right.
AI can help summarize that, right? But to have AI write your podcast is something different, right?
Right.
So I think that, like, that's where I would like, that's how we use it. Now, I think that we're going to see it in the future, both sides. I think that a lot of the larger companies are going to try to find ways to cut costs, and they're going to put AI in the forefront. And then I think you're going to get a lot of companies that are utilizing it more for support roles to help create strategies, right? And I think that's where it's very positive. I think when we start to rely on it on the creative side is where things are going to get a little stale and possibly even a little dangerous, but it's inevitable. You know, I'm excited about the predictive AI because I think that'll help a lot of the smaller groups compete with the larger ones.
Yeah, level the playing field. Do you think, though, when the big guys, when they start cost savings using AI, aggregating, kind of taking some of those lower positions, like you said, data analytics, yeah, et cetera, that's what it does. Do you think they'll either A, just keep those revenues and the cost savings, or do you think they'll reinvest that into the creative? Because I think the creative will become the driver for new money, because it's kind of like now with all the social media platforms, right? It was everyone who started creating AI videos, and it was that kind of hot buzz, and now platforms are rewarding creators who actually make content, who create something from scratch. It's a real person. They're like, no, we're going to reward people who actually put effort and work into it. Do you think the big companies will do that kind of same thing with the creative if and when they have those cost savings?
So, you know, sad answer, not voluntarily. Mm. I think they will have to. You know, I think that we're already starting to see companies utilize it for reservation systems, for answering, for analytics, copywriting, marketing, because it's still new, right? People can't really tell. On LinkedIn, which I think was one of the largest, you're starting to see people recognize the algorithms of the way things are written, right? I saw my very first human-driven on someone's website or something. So I think that the larger companies will utilize it as much as possible to make profits. Then I think there'll be a tipping point where their profits will start to be reduced because people won't want to go to them. Their experiences will fail. And then they're going to start saying, oh my God, we got to take this money and reinvest it in something, right? Hopefully it becomes, it's more proactive, but you know, we all know what happens in our industry when the hedge funds and the corporate side comes in. You know, they need to be, they learn in a reactive way, right?
Yeah.
But I like seeing the smaller groups utilize it to compete. You know, I really do. I think it's a nice it's a nice level of a playing field.
Oh yeah, it's the great equalizer for sure, because you can take the same amount of data, as long as you know what you're doing, and can condense it down into what the big guys have, right? You have that same access now. Okay, last question on trends. You're around a lot of different types of stuff in the food world in general. Just give me your 2026 kind of food prediction. Like, what's going to be hot this year? What's going to be emerging?
Ooh. All right. Well, you know, I think it's going to continue from last year, but from the cocktail side, I think the low ABV is still going to continue to grow.
You know, I think the mini martini is kind of here to stay from the cocktail world. That's just, that's happening. You know, I think from the food side, you know, I think the, I don't really know the best way to say it, but like the international cuisine, I think will continue to be the leader, you know, like looking at cities like DC where, you know, 5-6 years ago, every developer, everybody who ever like wanted to reach out, they want to do a steakhouse, right? Got to do a steakhouse, DC, we got to do it, we got to do it. You look now at the top 10 restaurants in DC, it's Indian, it's Ethiopian, it's Thai, it's Vietnamese. Like, I think that is going to continue to grow. I think fortunately and unfortunately, robotics is going to be a big one. I think we're going to see the ones that dive into it kind of kitschy. You know, John George's little salad thing and the pizza, like those. But then I think we're going to see some real companies trying to utilize it to replace staff. That's just the, that's a trend that's going to continue to happen. And then I think wellness for a positive, maybe a little bit of negative on certain respects, it is really going to kind of create the parameters for a lot of the menu changes of next year, of this year.
Yeah, robotics is an interesting one because you've seen so many come and go and like Chowbotics and the Sally robot, the salad robot, and you're like, oh, this is legit. And then they go under, and then you're just like, okay, well, if that can't survive, what can? Because some of these mega robot arms everywhere, they cost so much money that it's like, well, who's going to invest in that unless you just have uber amounts of money to back it and for how long to prove a concept to turn a profit? It'll be interesting to see how, I still think we're a few years away for some of those robotics. I think like some of the fast casual serve, like you said, like the pizza machines that are on campuses where you can go up and order a pizza. Right. I think that kind of stuff's really going to pop more.
You know, I have a different theory. Like I think that, and it's a little scary, I don't want to get doomsday, but outside of the efficiency and the execution becomes the adaptation and the adoption of it, right? Like how comfortable are we at seeing robots, right? And having one in somewhere, it doesn't work, goes away, comes back. It kind of disarms us a little bit, right? And then eventually when the technology kind of gets there, and it really does start to replace jobs and replace positions and replace techniques, we're going to be desensitized to having it. And that's what kind of scares me a little bit, right? Where it's like, I already have, you know, my sister-in-law lives in Australia, right? And my wife bought this little robot, right? It's like a little dome guy that goes around the house.
And oh, the one that runs around and you can talk through it? Yeah, I've seen those.
And it has a little camera and you can talk to it, right? Yeah. And it's a robot, like straight up. It's a game, but it's a robot, right? So it's like, that was our first introduction. My kids are 4 and 8, right? So they're going to be used to that, right? So in 2 years, if we brought in a robot nanny, it wouldn't be weird, right? Or like, there's this one robot dog thing that like all the kids love right now. And it's like, will that actually replace a pet one day? So I think it's this like, it's a little bit of trial and error, and it's also a little bit of desensitization on like where our line is, especially in hospitality. You know, we are trying to create parameters. You know, when we get advisory roles in luxury and lifestyle, you know, our number one thing is, does a guest talk or touch? If so, don't use AI. Don't use it for that, right? Mm. And, you know, don't get me wrong. We get a lot of people come back and say, you're not the company for us. We want someone who's going to, you know, take 15 systems and use AI for us and save us a ton of money. And, you know, that's what we want. You're like, no problem. But, you know, to us, that's not what the industry is.
Yeah. You know personally. Who you are. You know what you want to be. And that's, I think you got to keep it. Keep, don't ever change that. And I think that'll pay dividends in the long run because that's what people want. They want authenticity. They want real. They're seeing through a lot of that crap nowadays. So yeah, keep being you. So I know we're coming up on time. Hit me up with socials, where people go, and then any last parting words for the audience.
Yeah. You know, our website's probably the best. So that's barrelagedmgmt.com. We're not really huge in social media. I think this will be our first year. This is actually my first podcast.
Love it.
I've ever done. Yeah. And, you know, I think, listen, for the words of wisdom of 2026, like you said, I think this is the year of action, right? I think that, you know, we really saw a lot of questionables in 2025. What's going to happen here? What's going to happen there? Is it doomsday? And I think we're all starting to realize, listen, the world's a tough place. Hospitality is a hard one. It's going to continue to be like that. It's always been like that. And if you want to be successful in it, you know, make it a lifestyle, not a job.
Make it a lifestyle, not a job. Great, great last words. Seth, thanks so much for taking the time to come on today.
Hey, Jeff, it was great.
We're going to blow your social media open out the door with this one, and we'll get it rocking and rolling. So, as always, if you like this episode, have any guests you want to see, be sure to check us out, Spotify, Apple, YouTube. You know all the places to go. Like, comment, review, all that crazy good stuff that helps us out. So until next time, we'll catch you on the sunny side. HospitalityChain.com, the world's first online hub designed for the hospitality, culinary, and catering industry. From leading food and beverage brands to professional food service equipment, HospitalityChain.com makes sourcing simple. Search, select, buy direct, and save all in one global marketplace.